So welcome everyone. Thank you for coming today. For those who are new, I'm not sure on what dates, but there is a whole series of orientations to mindfulness, to meditation, some longer, some shorter. So if anybody is new and wants more detailed instruction about meditation and the practice of mindfulness in all aspects, please, I guess there'll be announcements about that. So I wanted to continue somewhat with some of the teachings that we've been focusing on the past month, and then to share with you some poems. Those of you who've been coming the past month or 6 weeks know that I've been sharing some teachings from a great Chinese Chan or Zen master by the name of Lin Chi. One of the great lights of Chinese Zen, and for those who are familiar with Thich Nhat Hanh, Thich Nhat Hanh's Vietnamese Zen lineage comes from Lin Chi. So he's a great patriarch within our tradition, and one of the things that I shared with you was his teaching about host and guest. So I want to just begin today by fast-forwarding Lin Chi was, 8th, 9th century, but then there is this sort of modern-day great Chinese master. His name was Xu Yun. Xu Yun was an extraordinary, one of the last great lights of Chinese Zen, Chan. He lived 120 years. He actually was born in the 1850s, and he actually lived into the 1970s. And his biography or autobiography is available, and it's quite fascinating because he really lived, from the middle of the 1800s into the 19th, so tremendous changes in China, including the coming of communism, and even had very horrific encounters with the Red Guards in the 70s, so it's quite a story, but he was a great master. So this is just a little something, and it sort of ties into what we've been teaching. So this is interesting because this is in his preliminaries. So it's sort of like how to start your practice. Somebody might consider this a little advanced, but it's very interesting that he saw that getting kind of certain things straight right from the beginning was very important. So he says, how should one begin to practice? In the Sarangam Assembly, he's referring to one of the great Mahayana sutras, the Sarangama Sutra. The Honored One mentioned the two words, guest and dust. This is where beginners, and all of us here are beginners on this path, this is where beginners should begin their practice. He said, quote, a traveler who stops at an inn may stay overnight or get something to eat. When he or she is finished or rested, they pack up and continue their journey, for one does not have a time to stay longer. If that person was the host, he or she would have no place to go. Thus I reason. He or she who does not stay is called a guest, because not staying is the essence of being a guest. He's making this very simple. But he's making a profound point. Just hang on there a minute. See, he understands we're very slow and confused, so he's kind of going boom, 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 just defining his terms very clearly. He who stays is a host. Okay, we all get that clear. There's the host and the guest and the host. Now again, in case we didn't get that, he goes, again, on a clear day when the sun rises and the sunlight enters a dark room through an opening, one can see dust in empty space. The dust is moving, but the space is still. That which is clear and still is called space. That which is moving is called dust, because moving is the essence of dust. Okay? Guestin does refer to illusory thoughts, whereas host and space refer to self-nature. That the permanent host does not follow the guest in his or her comings or goings illustrates that permanent self-nature does not follow illusory thoughts in their fleeting rise and fall. Therefore it was said, quote, if one is unaffected by things, then there will be no obstructions, even if one is constantly surrounded by things. So this is very simple and yet revolutionary. I hope you're somewhat getting the point that Shuyin is making here, right? This is a little grosser than what he's talking about, but if you think about it, each of us, we could say, is the host and has been the host of our life, right? In other words, from as far back as you can remember, things have happened, right? Hours, weeks, months, days, years have passed, come and gone. People have come and gone. Experiences have come and gone. Situations have come and gone. All kinds of emotional feelings, positive and negative, have come and gone, right? But you're still here, listening to this, right? So in a certain sense, each of us is the host of our life. And these endless experiences, right? Momentary experiences, longer-term experience, they all just come and go, don't they? Even our life today and all the things in it. Everything that is appearing in it are guests, aren't they? We don't know how long they're going to stay, do we? But the one thing we do know is they're not going to be around forever. Because all our experiences are simply the guest. And we are the host of our life. Is that clear? Now, why is that so important? Right? Remember, he ends saying, if one is unaffected by all things, then there will be no obstructions, even when one is constantly surrounded by things. Because in our life, what are we obsessed about? What are we addicted to? What are we constantly ruminating about? Responding to, reacting to? It's all the what? It's all the comings and goings of life. It's all the guests. Right? Rather than that which is really key, which is what? The host. The host is what stays. Is that clear? Right? If you're running an inn, you make sure that your rooms are clean, right, and everything is well taken care of. All different kinds of guests will come in and out of your inn, right? Nice ones, not nice ones, ones who clean up after themselves, ones who don't clean up after themselves, right? Some that are very kind and sweet, some are obnoxious, but it doesn't matter. Because why? Because they all come and go. And after they've gone, that's fine. Right? You know, if after we left the inn or the hotel, what would we see? Somebody's coming in after us, cleaning up the room, and it's as if we were never there. Right? They don't give us a thought. So, that is the truth about life. But he's also saying more intimately, that is the truth of our minds. This is where meditation and mindfulness is so important. Right? Because as you've all learned today, for those of you who even are new, when you sit in mindfulness, you notice what? Lots of guests coming and going. Have you noticed that? Right? They just keep coming and going. whether you want them to or not. Right? Thoughts come and go, feelings come and go, sensations in the body, pleasant and unpleasant, come and go, memories might come and go, right? They all just come and go. Now, that is why the instruction is, learn to hold things in mindfulness. Right? Identify with the host. Right? Because all the thoughts, all the feelings, all the perceptions, good ones, bad ones, nice ones, not nice ones, they're all things that you are aware of. Right? All things that you are aware of. Well, which is more important? These things that are constantly coming and going, constantly changing, all these endless guests, or that which is aware of them, the host? Again, in his analogy about dust and space, you know what he's talking about. When the sunlight streams in, all of a sudden we realize what? How dusty our house is. Right? So much dust in the air. And yet that dust is what? Just floating through. Floating through what? Space. Empty space. And that empty space is not disturbed by the dust, is it? And yet our minds, our emotions are constantly disturbed by the dust that's passing through. Whether we are young or old, whether we are long-term practitioners or short-term practitioners, the truth is the same. The important thing about practice is not getting rid of the guests. You know, that's one solution. Right? That's what people get to. I'm just so damn sick of all these guests coming and going. Right? And the way they act and the way they treat, and some clean up and some don't clean up. And some meet my expectations, some don't meet my expectations. I'm just sick of the whole damn thing, and I'm just going to close down the hotel. I'm just going to go out of business. That's what many people think is the answer. But you don't want to shoot yourself in the foot, so to speak. You don't want to cut off your source of income. There may be another way, which is what? How do I change my relationship to the guests? How can I be a wiser host? And that's what spiritual practice is about. That's what mindfulness and meditation is about, is not changing everything, but changing the way I relate to everything. Right? When I want to change everything, I have taken upon myself an incredible job, right? I have to be busy day and night, interfering, manipulating, controlling. If it's my job to change everything and everyone, to make them all into what? The kind of guests that I want to have. Many people are like that in their life, in their minds. They're only, you know, I just want one kind of guest, right? In my life, I only want one kind of guest in my mind. Again, that is untenable. You know, we'd have to go far up into the mountains. We'd have to shut ourselves off in our rooms, our homes, to achieve that. There is a better way, which is to change. I just got to change this one. That's much easier. Oh, if I just change the way the host, the whole experience is going to change. Is that clear? So this traditional analogy of host and guest is profound. You don't have to be an enlightened Buddha. You don't have to be practicing for 50 years to get this. It's actually almost like just changing your view of things and beginning to see all your experiences, external experiences, all your internal experiences, thought, feelings, perceptions, as simply guests that come and go, come and go, come and go. And how do I want the host to be? Each of us is the host of our life and of our minds. What kind of host do you want to be? Do you want to be a relaxed host? Do you want to be a free and easy host? Do you want to be a wise and compassionate host? Do I want to be an uptight host? Do I want to be a stressed out host? Do I want to be an emotional up and down host? I mean, that's what the spiritual life is about. It's not a thing out there. It's not something out there, I become a spiritual person. No, it's I become a transformed person in my life simply by the way I relate to experience. In Buddhism, we call this phenomena, dharmas. How does one relate to dharmas? Dharmas are things. So how do I relate to the things I see and the things I smell and the things I taste and the things I hear, right? And internally, how do I relate to the sensations in my body? How do I relate to thoughts, feelings, perceptions, memory? See, if there's nobody home, if we're just, just spinning around in life, reacting to everything, up and down and back and forth and happy and sad and attached and averting and, right? One crisis after another. And we think the cause of that is the world. Or we think the cause of that is my thoughts. I got to just change my thoughts. I just got to stop thinking. Right? Many people think that. No, it's much simpler than that. You got to change the relationship to your thoughts. When you change your relationship with your thoughts, your mind will change. That is why we say in mindfulness meditation, the emphasis is on mindfulness of. It doesn't matter what the of is. Right? You can have good thoughts arising in your mind, you could have not good thoughts arising in your mind. And you're just aware. I'm aware that there's angry thoughts, or irritated thoughts, or anxious thoughts, or sad thoughts, or happy thoughts, or joyful thoughts, or compassionate thoughts, right? You're just aware. When there is awareness, there is the capacity of choice. That's freedom. But it's a much different kind of freedom than the freedom of choosing your breakfast cereal in Publix. Right? It's a freedom that you know you do not have to be bound by the things that are arising in your mind. If you can hold things in mindfulness, in awareness, and if you can see all this phenomena that's arising as simply guests, they just come, everybody knows that, right? See, we all know it. Everything in your life up to now, all those hours and minutes and weeks and months and years and decades, all those people, all those experiences, all those relationships, they were all what? Guess. Because none of them have stayed, and the ones that have stayed have changed. That's the truth. And when you understand that and understand that every experience and relationship and person and situation in your life is no different today. They're all guests. When you know that, you change your relationship to them. But if you think they're permanent, solid things, what happens? We suffer. That's what the Buddha said, was we suffer. But if we're awake means if we see clearly how things really are, then we have the capacity for freedom, for ease, for joy, for well-being, for real, a deeper kind of happiness than the happiness we get when we get things right in the world. When everybody's acting the way they should and things are going just the way I want them to, right? We call that what? Happiness. But that's a worldly happiness because it's only predicated on just what we, you know, getting what we want. It's a control manipulative strategy. And the problem with it is it's not stable. And we often, what? We often don't get what we want. Or we get what we want and it turns out over time not to be what we really want. Right? Or we get what we want and we lose it. And so we're just up and down, up and down, up and down. Any questions about this? So these are one of these wonderful things where it's very simple and yet profound. And we have to remember this. And we have to internalize it. We internalize it by reflection, and we internalize it by meditation. So we really know it from the inside. You sit in meditation like we do today, over and over, year after year, and you begin to get it. Thoughts just come and go. Anybody only have one thought today? or just have the same thought, like just kind of long, you know, drawn out? We laugh because why? Because that's stupid. Because we've all sat here together and we know the truth that what? Thoughts just come and go. They're unstable. Right? And they're not grounded in reality, are they? You can think anything. Right? You can think meditation's great. You can think meditation's terrible. Right? And it'll change within a couple of minutes. That's how unstable it is. You can think that way about people, situations, the weather. I mean, it's this mind of ours is out of control and not grounded in reality. So we have to develop something within us that is. So are there any questions about this? Yes.
Deep in our bodies.
Well, in the deeper sense, yeah. Everything's impermanent. Everything's coming and going. I know where our bodies are, right? Our health is, our age is, right? Once we entered this world and we took on a body, right? It just keeps unfolding. We get bigger and then we start getting smaller, right? I mean, that's just the way it is, right? We get more and more energy, and then we get less and less energy. Eventually, we have no energy. That's called death, right? And then we realize the body also is just a guest. It's also something that we have temporary relationship with. And that's important, too, because we also are very attached, and we spend a lot of time trying to keep this guest a certain way, but it won't respond to us, right? It gets sick when we want it to be healthy. It ages when we want it to stay young, right? And it dies when we want it to stay here forever. And that's important that we understand so we can relate to the body with clarity and understanding. Yes.
I sort of wouldn't be here unless I had a unless I share your opinion, but what would you say to the professional psychologist who would say, die is cast by the time you're
what?
The die is cast by the time you're five, the personality architecture is in place, these things. So how do you answer that sort of scientific, so-called scientific?
Well, yeah, I would say so-called. I'm glad you said that. Yeah, it's yeah, the question is, I'm getting a cue up there to repeat the question. So the question is, how would you respond to a behavioral psychologist or something who might say, no, you know, everything is concrete. By the time a child is 5 years old, everything is set, right? And that's just the way it is. Well, that's patently untrue. Right? Nobody is the way they were when they were five. If they are, we call that developmentally delayed. I mean, there's a term for that. Right? All we know is, right, is that in Buddhism it's called causes and conditions. It's called karma. Right? Why are things the way they are? Because of causes and conditions. Okay? So we can certainly say that the infant, you know, almost from birth, if not at birth, growing up in the matrix of its family, growing up in the matrix of its society, this very unconditioned thing, that's all of us, becomes conditioned, right? Because it's constantly being influenced, right? Verbally, non-verbally, right? And so we can say that that conditioning takes place. Where we would differ is we would say fixed. See, if it was fixed, then the infant would have been born with all of it, if it's fixed. If something is permanent, it's permanent. But that's not true, right? That infant, by the time it was 5 years old, has been conditioned, right? And that means all of us. We've been conditioned. And it didn't stop at five. It continued on, okay? Until when? Until right now, right? So our conditioning, our past, our experiences have all conditioned us to be the way we are right now. That's the truth, right? Everybody in here is the way they are because of their causes and conditions. Is that clear? None of us know who we really are if we hadn't been caused and conditioned. Now, what we're learning through Buddhism or Dharma or this is that conditioning can be reconditioned. That's what spiritual practice is about. It's profound. It says that, you know, that's the trouble with those kinds of ideas, that path is passed as truth. Because the message is to somebody who believes that is what? I'm stuck. Spirituality, the path of enlightenment, is radically different. It says, what does it say? Let's say I'm just talking about Buddhism because that's what I know. Buddhism says everybody can be a Buddha. Is that clear? Everybody has the potential to be a Buddha. Everybody has the potential to be enlightened. Everybody has the seeds of all the positive qualities within, and they can be cultivated. Right? Nothing is fixed. Right? One of the foundations of Buddhist psychology is everything's impermanent. You might have heard that, which is the opposite, you know, of everything is fixed or permanent. It's a very different universe. Now, we need to understand what are the keys about this process of change and transformation. That's what spiritual practice is about. It's like very clearly understanding cause and effect. Right? And all of a sudden, as opposed to most of us just having been the recipient, the reactor to situations, we all of a sudden become what? Empowered. Yeah, this has been my life up to now, but now that I understand that it's just causes and conditions that have brought me here, I can chart a new path for myself in life. it doesn't mean it's like I turn on a dime, but it means I can chart a different life, a path in life. In Buddhism, that's called the path to awakening, the path to enlightenment, the path to liberation, the path to freedom. You know, there are lots of names. It all means the same things. It means I have the potential to become, in a certain way, whoever I want. Because I am the way I am now because of conditioning. Right? Just imagine, everybody, that rather than being born to your parents, you have been born to the parents of the people next door. Well, that's interesting. Right? I mean, I don't know who the people next door were in your life, but think about that. What if you had been mixed up, you know, one of those things where you get mixed up at birth and sort of given to the people next door? You'd be very different. Some qualities would be the same, we know that. But causes and conditions might have produced a very different life for you. Spiritual practice is about taking, understanding that each of us have that power within us, right? No matter where you have been. We know that, don't we? People, you know, who spent 20, 30 years in prison, some of them transform, don't they? Right? You know, many people, they don't know anything about Dharma or spirituality, change significantly, don't they? We know that. Many, many people, could be people in this room, rise above their causes and conditions, don't they? Right? I mean, we love those kinds of stories. So that's the truth. Again, it's not either or, it's just understanding that that process to 5 years old has taken place. It is significant, but it can't mean that it can't be changed and modified. Nothing is fixed. But somebody who says that is giving people, I think, a very misguided message. Buddhism is very optimistic about the potential that each of us have for transformation. So let me read an interesting poem. It's sort of on these lines a little bit. So I came across this poem, and maybe I'm sort of the last one to pick up on it. It's a poem called Be Not Defeated by the Rain. It's a translation of a poem by a kind of a modern Japanese poet called Kenji Miyazawa. And from what I read, he was an interesting guy, born in the late 1890s. He died in his 30s, in the 30s. And even though this was a period in Japan of industrialization and militarization and all that, he kind of went on his own path. He was a very spiritual person. He devoted to helping farmers, leading a simple life, kind of rejected the way his world was going, and basically died fairly obscure. I think he'd written a couple of children's books or something, but most of his stuff hadn't been published. And I don't know the whole story, but somehow after he died, there was like this notebook that was found, and there was this poem written in it. And I guess over these past decades, he's become more well-known. And I guess what's significant about this poem is after the tsunami, you know, a number of years ago, there was that horrific tsunami. I guess somebody at some sort of public gathering read this poem. And I guess many people felt it kind of captured the traditional Japanese spirit. So now he's really in a process of being rediscovered. Now again, maybe you know all this, but it's all new to me. So let me share this poem. I think it's quite wonderful, and I think it somewhat relates to what we were just talking about, but in a different way. And it was interesting. I found about three or four translations of it. And it's just amazing. It's just a good caution to us that when we're reading something that's been translated from another language, we should find as many translations as we can, because they're all very different. You know, I mean, sort of like our conditioning, more or less in the same direction, but very different. So I've chosen just one of them. And his name is David Sulz, S-U-L-Z. That's his translation of this poem by Kenji Miyazawa. And let me read it through. Be not defeated by the rain, nor let the wind prove your better. Succumb not to the snows of winter, nor be bested by the heat of summer. Strong in body, unfettered by desire, not enticed to anger, cultivate a quiet joy. Count yourself last in everything. Put others before you. Watch well and listen closely. Hold the learned lessons dear. A thatch roof house in a meadow, nestled in a pine grove shade. A handful of rice, a miso, and a few vegetables to suffice for the day. If to the east a child lies sick, go forth and nurse her to health. If to the west an old lady stands exhausted, go forth and relieve her of her burden. If to the south a man lays dying, go forth with words of courage to dispel his fear. If to the north an argument or fight ensues, go forth and beg them to stop such a waste of effort and spirit. In times of drought, shed tears of sympathy. In summer's cold, walk in concern and empathy. Stand aloof of the unknowing masses. Better dismissed as useless than flattered as a great man. This is my goal, the person I strive to become. So that's the poem. I don't know how much there needs to be said. It's kind of clear. And it sort of ties into what... in an interesting way, again, it talks about, again, I think a person who's following a spiritual path, a transformative path, a path of freedom, you want to be acting from your own compass, right? Most people are not acting from their own compass, right? Their ideas, their view, their actions are so much driven by other people's, right? We want to be liked. We want to get along. Right? We want to be thought of in some way by other people. We're concerned why other people think about us, how they perceive us. We're often concerned about how you know, we have an image of how we want to be perceived. Right? But I think the true man or woman of spirit, it's something much deeper. The values you hold to, the way you want to be in the world, comes from within, and it is not disturbed by how you're responded to. So again, where he says in the beginning, be not defeated by the rain, nor let the wind prove you're better, succumb not to the snows of winter, nor be bested by the heat of summer. He's just talking about what? Life. And that sometimes life, you know, right? It blows you this way or that. Right? We know there's been a lot of rain lately. Not to be bested by anything means you don't have your mood affected by it. So many people, our moods are affected by these external things, how things are going, whether things are going well or not going well. how people are treating me or not treating me, right? Our ups and downs, our happinesses, our unhappinesses, our frustration, you know, it's all predicated on the externality. And he's saying, you know, don't be defeated, don't be bested by, don't succumb to all these externals. Have your own clarity about how you want to live. He says, be strong in body, unfettered by desire. Unfettered by desire, it means that, you know, again, so many people, they're just a bundle of desires. Who am I? I'm just a bundle of desires. You know, point me in any direction, and I'll have a bundle of desires in that direction. Point me in that direction, I'll have a bundle of desire. You know, anywhere I go, my mind is always full of wishes and desires and hopes and, right? That's not a mind at peace. That's not a mind that has clarity. That's not a mind that has stability. Again, it's not like, you know, having a desire is necessarily bad. But desires, even little ones, are unsettling. And people just spend their whole life always placating their desires. And they wonder why they never really get to a meaningful place in their life. Right? It's like, I want to go there, but I'm always taking these little detours because of these temporary desires. We might call these guests, referring back to earlier. Desires are guests. Anybody, how many desires do you think we have during the day? Anybody ever count them up? And that's our life, endless desires. In Buddhism, we really want to replace all these little, tiny, stupid, meaningless desires with a big desire. What is a big desire that's a good desire?
An awakened life.
I want to be free of suffering. I desire to be of benefit to people. Right? I really want to be happy and free, right? We might say, well, that's a desire, but I'd say that's a good desire. That's pointing you in the right direction. Right? If you have a good desire, a meaningful desire, a real direction for your life, then you won't get always sidetracked. Most people are just endlessly sidetracked. Even people sitting here who in their hearts say they have a spiritual aspiration. And most people never arrive at the destination. Why not? Because we have all these side roads we're endlessly taking that get in, that distract us. We put our energy into. Be strong in body, unfettered by desire, not enticed by anger. I like that. He didn't say what? Don't be angry. He said, don't be enticed by anger. I think that's a very good translation, right? Because we are enticed by anger, aren't we? We like being angry, don't we? Why do we like being angry? Who's going to be honest? Why do we like being angry? We certainly spend a lot of time in it. Yeah, we like feeling right.
Important.
Yeah, we feel important. We're right. Yeah. What? They're all a bunch of idiots. What? Yeah, we get it. Mobilizes energy. Yeah. Right. She says, don't be enticed by that. It's not a. There are better ways. There are better emotions than anger. Cultivate a quiet joy. So this is not the Comedy Channel. Right? This is not Saturday Night Live kind of joy. Okay, this is a quiet joy. Something that comes from inside. It's just a sense of well-being, a sense of happiness. Like from the inside. Quiet joy. Now this is a hard one for us. Count yourself last in everything. Put others before you. Actually, at the end of the month, we're having this Tibetan Geshe, this great teacher, good teacher coming, who's going to be giving an all-day workshop on these eight verses of mind training that are all about this. In the verses it says, give victory to others. Take defeat upon yourself. It's famous lines in the Bodhisattva path. Right? I mean, what's more un-American than that? Right? Right? What a thing. Give victory to others. I'll take defeat. Put others before you. Right? We're taught what? Be first. Right? Be first. Be the best. Win. Very interesting. I could give a whole Dharma talk on this, but it's really quite wonderful. Why do you give victory to others and put others before you? Why do that? Yeah, so one thing is the betterment of the whole. Which again, you often find in traditional societies that are much more, have a sense of the common, is you want the whole to succeed. In our society, which puts such an emphasis on individuality, we think what? The individual should succeed. Let the whole take care of themselves. But in this traditional way, which is very much a Buddhist way, is, yeah, I want society to develop. I want other people. Let them be first, if it makes them happy. But it's also because you have this inner joy. You have this inner contentment. So you're like, yeah. If they want to be first, let them be first. Right? What do I care? Right? You know, when people are running around in traffic trying to get out of their way. I mean, there's some people who like to hassle those people. I mean, let me slow down a little bit. Or Right, you know. Well, let them get there first. If they want to get first in line, let them get first in line. What do we care? Right? It's not a big deal. A thatch roof house, meadow, nestled in a pond, grove shade, handful of rice. So he's talking about what? Simple living. Simple living. How much is enough? Right? That's such an American question, right? When do we have enough? Right? There's a whole sector of society that thinks what? What? It's never enough. There's always more, right? There's always more. What was that one in the 90s? Where that? The one who has the most toys. What was that one? He who dies with the most toys wins or something. I mean, that was like, people thought that was great. I mean, what a motto for life. The purpose of life is to accumulate as more toys than anybody else. You know, that's like kindergarten stuff. You know? I mean, my little grandson would probably think that was a great, you know, more toys. Yeah, that'd be great. I mean, we were supposed to have developed since being 5 years old. But it doesn't seem to work that way. So this is, you know, to suffice for the day. So again, we may not have a thatch-roofed house, we may not live in a meadow nestled in a pine grove shade, we may not just be eating a little rice and vegetables, but I think the point he's saying, have enough, have shelter, right? Have shelter, have food, you know, enough to take care of yourself. But that's, how much more do you need? Right? I mean, this... You know, that's a question we should ask ourselves. How much do I need to what? To be happy. See, we never ask ourselves that question. You know. When is enough enough? What is enough? You know, do each of us know what our enough is? That we can relax? And maybe do other things in our life, right? Than getting more rooms in the house or a bigger this or more that. You know, maybe there are other more meaningful things we could be doing with our lives and our energy rather than accumulating. And then he sort of says, well, then you might say, all right, so then what do you do? And he has these beautiful lines, you know, if a child lies sick, go forth and nurse him. If an old lady's exhausted, go relieve her of a burden. If somebody's dying, go forth to dispel any fears they have. If somebody's arguing, you know, show them that they're wasting their effort and spirit. When there's time of drought, be sympathetic. If the summer, I guess he lived among farmers, if all of a sudden the summer is cold, so their crops aren't growing probably, walk in concern and empathy. Oh, that's the purpose of life, right? Oh, if I'm not running around indulging my every desire, and if I'm not running around accumulating, what am I doing? That's a good question. Oh, I'm helping people. Right? I'm helping people. I'm concerned about others. I'm concerned about the state of my society. I'm concerned about those who are less fortunate. I'm concerned about those who are suffering. Maybe that's, right? Maybe that's very a meaningful way to spend my time and live my life. And then he really says something. He says, stand aloof of the unknowing masses. Sort of ties in with that thing we were talking about earlier, about having your own internal compass. Right? The masses are what? The majority. Right? The majority. The values of the majority. The ideas of the majority. He says, stand aloof of the unknowing. What is it that they don't know? They don't know how to be happy. They don't know what a meaningful life is. They think accumulating more toys, getting ahead, having a better roof, having more things, right, more choices, you know, that this is happiness. Getting there first. Me, me, me. Look at me. I'm number one. Look at me. Right? Kind of sad, isn't it? Stand aloof of the unknowing masses. Better dismissed as useless than flattered as a great man or great woman. Whew. Right? If there's a great man or great woman contest and they're giving out the certificate, whose name do we want called? Me. Right? I want to get the great man certificate. I want to see my name up in lights, don't we? I want to hear the applause. Better dismissed as useless than flattered as a great man. Now what he's talking about what? He's talking about, again, the unknowing masses. Right? Think about these people who in the news that people care about, right? You know what came into mind? Donald Trump. I mean, it's like unbelievable. Right? Right? I mean, this is what people, these are the kind of people that people even give any consideration to. That they call newsworthy, right? And these other kind of celebrities with these empty, meaningless lives that get front page kind of and that people read about, right? You know, that's the unknowing masses, right? When people of real value, people of real substance, people of real, who are doing meaningful, purposeful things with their life, even in small ways, right? He said, I'd rather be one of those that society would dismiss as, oh, they're useless, people like that. Is that clear? He said, I'd rather them call me useless than on that scale be called a great man or great woman. This is my goal, the person I strive to become. So anyway, I thought this was a very wonderful I don't think the poem has a name, so if you want to look online, it seems like whatever they call the first line is the name of the poem. So like this one was called Be Not Defeated by the Rain. Another translation said Unbeaten by the Rain. Another translation said Strong in the Rain. But I think you get the drift. So we'll stop here. Thank you.